It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, should the spouses or closer relatives of former presidents be allowed to run for the White House themselves? Our guest says they shouldn't, and he says we need a constitutional amendment to make it that way. First, students, teachers, and parents alike have been dealing with big changes to what a school day looks like. It hasn't always gone smoothly, but some people in the education world see this as an opportunity to rethink the way we teach and how we expect students to learn. For one example, online learning has been a mixed bag, but it has had benefits for some students, and we've learned a lot of lessons along the way. Could virtual learning play a bigger role in the future post-COVID world? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you look forward to school going back to normal, the way things were before, or do you think there should be a new normal with some changes and lessons learned? Has this past year made you think differently about the way we educate our children? Do you think more virtual options should be on the table? Do you have a kid maybe in your own house who benefited in some ways from more online learning? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Paul Revel is professor of practice of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He's also the founding director of the Education Redesign Lab. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Before we dive into some specific changes and outcomes of this last year of education, is there a sense in the education world that, hey, maybe we don't have to go back to normal the way it used to be, that this unintended experiment could give us some good lessons we can learn from?
Well, I'm not sure it's an either-or proposition. I think virtually everybody in the world of education wants to go back to in-person in some way, shape, or form, whether that in-person resembles identically what we did earlier or whether it is sort of the central core of the education business, but allows for us to apply some of the tools of distance learning to add to education options for our children and to compensate for some of the equity gaps that have developed. That remains to be seen. So I prefer to see it as sort of a both and proposition. We should return to in person, but we should add some of the affordances that the new technology brings to us.
Yeah, can you talk about what that might look like? Could we see more hybrid options for certain learners in the future where, yeah, they're in school some, but they're doing part of their day virtually?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility because, as you pointed out in your intro, there are a number of children and families who've liked this kind of arrangement and to be able to use home as a base from which to learn. I think more importantly, you know, the educational technology and the concept of remote learning, distance learning, enables us to break down the barriers of time and of geography and space and time that kind of lock us into the typical agrarian schedule, which is left over from, you know, a century ago around which our school system was built. So I think what we have is the possibility to personalize education a good deal more, to meet children where they are and give them what they need. So take, for example, providing after-school opportunities or summer learning opportunities. I think a fair amount of this could be done, or at least done partially, through making options available, as we've learned to do, online. So if some students come back and they've got significant learning gaps and they need more time than the typical education day involves, then there's the opportunity for us to stretch and provide instruction in hours after the traditional school day. We've known, for instance, for a long time that those who have summer learning opportunities tend to surge forward academically, and those who don't fall back. This would give us the opportunity to make those kind of summer learning options available at a reasonable price to a much larger number of students than have access to them now. So I think there are a number of possibilities here that I hope we'll explore and use some of these new federal dollars coming in to pioneer in the coming summer and in the next school year.
And that reminds me, we had, even before COVID-19, concerns in this country, in this state, about inequities among students of different backgrounds, of family, of wealth, ethnicity, and so on. Has this last year changed the way we think of that, maybe highlighted the importance of dealing with it, and maybe some methods to help deal with that?
Absolutely. It's I think it's been, you know, I've likened it to what we've experienced is kind of like an earthquake that's lifted a tidal wave off the ocean floor and revealed on that ocean floor profound inequities in the lives of children that get in the way of them coming to school or supplying their best effort if they get there. And I think society is much more aware of this. Issues like food, clothing, and shelter, internet access, a sense of safety, stable housing, dental care, vision care, in addition to mental health care and physical health care. So all these are critical issues, and I think they've been revealed in this crisis. And at the same time, we've had a social and racial justice crisis, and people are, I think now, significantly more aware of the inequities and the degree to which the coronavirus crisis and the closing of schools has made that crisis even worse. The gaps, whatever gaps we had before, have gotten even worse because those best able to persist and be resilient in this crisis have been those families who have the most resources, the most social and economic capital. And those who struggled most are naturally those students who are living in extreme disadvantage. Imagine if you are homeless or a foster child, or you didn't have internet access in your home, or you didn't have adequate computers or a hotspot to go to. You know, so we've had a lot of children falling significantly behind, and we're going to have to reckon with that. Most school districts have that on the top of their agenda as they think about the ways in which they're going to return to school.
Talking to Paul Revel, professor of practice of educational policy administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, looking at how schools have changed during the pandemic, whether there are some changes that we might learn from, some things we could do when we return to in-person or mostly in-person education consistently around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions for our guests. That's 800-642-1234. Paul, I know this last year has been stressful for a lot of students, a lot of everybody for that matter. Has this highlighted concerns about mental health problems facing kids and what schools can do to help deal with that?
Profoundly. In most states, I know in my home state of Massachusetts, the numbers of cases where students and their families have been asking for mental health services have skyrocketed far beyond the capacity of our mental health systems, let alone our school systems, to meet those needs. Now, this was a problem prior to the pandemic. It was a very common problem. As you travel around the country and talk to superintendents, they'd say, I've got a number of children coming into school with significant mental health issues, and I just don't have the staff to deal with them. But if I don't deal with them, it creates all kinds of problems in the lives of those children and in the lives of their classmates and teachers. So this is, again, a crisis beforehand, but now one that's even more acute, particularly as students encounter mental health problems just by virtue of being home, being isolated, having their relationships with friends and teachers cut off and fractured. So it's compounding and intensifying a number of problems, creating anxiety in students about going out in public, creating depression because they can't connect or don't have any kinds of distractions or recreation in their lives. So one of the primary reasons, for example, in Massachusetts, our commissioner of education has called students back into school is to provide them with some of the kinds of supports that are needed and some of the kind of preventative mechanisms that are in place when you have kids in school that aren't there when school is closed. That still won't solve the larger problem, which is we've got to do a better job in this society of meeting young people's mental health needs, or we can't possibly hope that schools will be successful with them if they're struggling with issues. It's no different than having significant dental issues or vision issues or health issues. If we don't treat those as basic, then you can't expect a student to concentrate or learn. And so we're going to have to stand up and address that. Schools being open is one step in the right direction. But I was glad to see that the new bill coming out of Congress to provide relief specifically provides money to school systems to hire social workers and counselors and people of this nature to help with some of these issues.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Allison is with us in Appleton. Allison, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What I just wanted to mention was my son has autism, and what I experienced was having him home and watching him in the virtual classroom, I was able to learn more about his learning style and understand how he operates, and then I was able to help him more now knowing, you know, he does participate a lot in class, or he's very emotional. And so while he was home, we were able to work on those things, which I think then in turn prepared him better for when he was able to get back into the classroom now.
Allison, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Paul, what do you think? I'm guessing Allison is not the only one who had a similar experience.
No, I think a lot of parents have found out it enables them to better understand what's going on in school and how they can be supportive of it by having this kind of connection. So a couple of things. One, you know, schools and families need to be more tightly connected now than they ever were before. We used to give a lot of lip service in education to the idea of family involvement, family engagement, but it really was a secondary or ancillary thought. And in many of our school systems, we spent very little time actually forming partnerships with parents. So I think we need to work harder on partnerships with parents. And secondly, goes to the point where we started, really, with this kind of technology, there's certain advantages for some kinds of students to get the supports and help that they need, which I think further underlines what I was calling for more generally, is that we need a more personalized, customized approach to education, where we meet children where they are, we recognize their differences, and we meet them where they are and give them what they need, instead of having a school system that basically is a factory model. We teach to the average, we batch process, mass produce education. Instead, we ought to be more like a case management medical model, where we don't give everybody who walks in the hospital the same treatment, the same length of stay. We say, where are you? What are your needs? What works best for you? And that's what we're going to get you. That's what we're going to prescribe for you. I think we need to begin to move that way in education as well.
Thanks for that call, Allison. We're talking to Paul Revel, professor of practice of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, former secretary of education, by the way, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about learning, the educational system, what has changed during the COVID era, and lessons we can learn for the post-COVID era. If you're a educator, parent, or student yourself, what do you think would make schools better? Is there something that has happened in the last year that you say, yeah, we need to keep some of that in the future? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Paul Revel, professor of practice of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, founding director of the Education Redesign Lab. We're talking about how education might change in the post-COVID era. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions and your experiences as a teacher or school staff member, a parent, or a student yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Barry joins us next in Madison. Barry, hello.
Good afternoon, Professor. Hello?
Yep, go ahead, Barry.
Hello.
Oop, are you still there, Barry?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead. Yep, we hear you loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Okay. Well, I've been in education, and I love what I'm hearing here from the professor. And I would like to kind of point out, well, I'm 74 years old. So I'm in the baby boom generation. You know, we're the first that really went on to college in a big way. And, you know, we have been instrumental in where our economy has evolved to. Now, if you go back to when I was a kid, there were millions and millions and millions of people growing up on farms, growing up in families with manufacturing. And so what I'm saying is there was a tremendous amount of experiential hands-on learning. And we have all but lost that. Our technical programs in high schools, for the most part across the country, are totally inadequate. And yet we, in the past, we've had all of these great people come up with all kinds of skills, became engineers, et cetera, and built the economy. Well, but now our education system is so focused on simply drill.
Gotcha. Barry, thanks a lot for the call. I want to throw this to Paul. So Barry, looking for, it sounds like, more hands-on experiential learning, less drill and memorization.
Yeah, well, I don't know many people who are prescribing memorization as a good approach these days, but the larger point that Barry makes is a good one. The economy's changed completely. Those manufacturing jobs and agricultural jobs that used to account for a large percentage of our families have in many instances disappeared. The requirements for 21st century high skill, high knowledge employment have increased dramatically. And we need to adjust our education systems to those realities. Now, around the country, there are some outstanding systems of career technical education, you know, what we formerly call vocational schools. And then there's some instances, and Barry seemed to be pointing to some of these, of those that, you know, vocational technical schools that have been sort of locked in former conceptions of what the work is and where employees were needed, and not up to date and not providing students the skills and knowledge they need to be viable in today's economy. I think in this crisis that we've just had, where teachers have had to reinvent curriculum in a lot of ways, the notion of doing more project-based learning, the notion of using the community, and that includes employers, as the source of problems that students come to solve and figure out how to apply skill and knowledge to some of the most pressing problems we have in our neighborhoods, in our cities, in our states, and in our nation. I think that's the way to go. I think we're going to see a lot more applied learning and project-based learning. And some of that will have grown directly out of our experience here in the pandemic, where teachers can't simply get online and lecture for an hour or use the traditional ways and means of educating. They've got to use the broader community and adults in the community as part of the education ecosystem. So I hope we'll see a good deal more of, you know, school to career kinds of pathways that get set up for our young people, because it's very much needed. I mean, we need to prepare young people to play a meaningful role in a 21st century economy, not only for them personally, so that they can make an income and be viable and have a family if they choose to do so, but also so they provide the ingredients for a growing economy in this country. That's what we very much need, and we've got to adjust our education systems accordingly.
Barry, thanks for the call. We got an email from Diana who says, as a sixth grade science teacher, I think that idea, more individualized education, is a great idea. However, I see 100 kids a day. How is that possible? Paul, what do you think?
That's a great question, Diana, and it points out the dilemma of a lot of teachers, that how do we personalize if we're working with those kinds of ratios? So, I mean, I think we need to rethink the roles. We need to rethink the ratios of students to teachers. We need to, for example, I think of our middle schools, and maybe Diana's in a middle school, you know, where we have students moving through, you know, blocks of 45 minutes each all day long, but not really connecting with any individual teacher. We have students in our middle schools and high schools going through a whole year of schooling without really being known or understood or responded to by any adult, because the adults are dealing with not just 100, but in many cases, 150 or close to 200 students a week. And it's just too many students to reckon with on a personal basis. So we're going to have to rethink and rebuild our schools in ways that foster relationships that make for deeper engagement and understanding between teachers and students. One example for you know, that you could apply easily enough in middle schools and high schools is having something they call an advisory, where students and teachers gather for a 45-minute period each day, which in effect becomes a guidance period, where a cohort of students comes together with a teacher who in effect is their guidance counselor. We're running guidance ratios of 1 to 3 or 4 or 500 these days. So students effectively don't get any guidance, or they don't get sufficient guidance. So, you know, you build that into part of the school day and make that part of a teacher's job description, and not just to get to know the student, but to get to know each student's family. I'd like to see teachers doing home visits with all their students, getting to know the families, and so on and so forth. So I think strengthening and building relationships is the only way to get to personalization. But we've got to restructure education in order to get there.
Time for one more caller. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
I just wanted to talk about the last issue that the email person just talked about with your guest comparing physician to patient and students and teachers making more connections. I think it's a great idea and great philosophy, but very difficult to put into play, considering, you know, I'd see 120 students every year, and individualizing every single student's curriculum to their needs would be ideal. It's a fantastic idea, but very difficult, hard to handle.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Paul, is this a case where we can do this by reshuffling resources we have, or do we need more resources to do that kind of thing you're talking about, more individualized work? In just our last minute or so.
Okay, Rob, I think it's a little bit of both, frankly. I mean, I do think it can't be on the teachers to figure this out. I mean, I think education policymakers and administrators would have to restructure the school day, restructure the school year, redefine what we mean by the responsibilities for a teacher, for a guidance counselor, for administrators within a building. I think you'll need some increased investment to attend to the variety of needs that are likely to come up when you start really focusing individually on what students need inside and out of school. But I think it's highly possible to do it. And I think we've got a number of schools around the country that are working on it.
Thanks for that call. And Paul, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Rob, my pleasure. Thanks for having me with you.
That's Paul Revel, professor of the practice of educational policy and administration at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, founding director there of the Education Redesign Lab. He joined us today to talk about how the pandemic is reshaping education and maybe some lessons we can take out on the other side. Makes the case that we should bar close relatives themselves in order to prevent political dynasties in the United States. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, public transportation took a big hit during the pandemic, but it's still out there. We'll find out how bus and other SIP systems adapted and the financial impact of lower ridership during social distancing. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the 22nd Amendment was ratified 70 years ago, limiting the president to serving 2 4-year terms, a move aimed at preventing any one person from solidifying too much power. But how about one family? The United States has seen its share of powerful political families. The Adamses, Roosevelts, Bushes all had 2 members serve as president. Others have had a big influence on elections, even when they didn't win multiple terms. Our guest says these political dynasties are bad for the country, and we should consider passing a new amendment that would bar the spouses, siblings, or children of former presidents from winning the presidency themselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea, family members of ex-presidents being ineligible to serve in the White House? Do you worry about the effect that some of the more powerful families in politics have on the government? If another member of the Trump or Obama or Clinton or Bush family ran for president, would you consider voting for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Philip Wallach is a senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he researches the separation of powers and Congress. He wrote about this for Politico magazine. Philip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, do you think we have a political dynasty problem here in the country, or at least an issue with presidential families having just a little too much influence?
This was something on my mind in 2015 as we were gearing up for the presidential election the next year. And there looked like a pretty serious possibility that 2016 would be Clinton versus Bush. And I imagined what a school child learning about the American presidency of the late 20th century, early 21st century would learn. And it would be Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Clinton or Bush. They would think that you had to be a member of one of these two families to become president in our country, which just seemed so awful to me. And obviously that's not how things turned out, but it is the case that Jeb Bush's presence in the 2016 election seriously distorted the contest on the Republican side. And I think it is the case now that people are too ready to think of the Republican Party as the Trump family party, as if somehow this family is likely to just have a lock over the nominations in the years to come. And I think that's immensely unhealthy. And I think it would be good to have an amendment in the Constitution just making it impossible.
Before we get into how an amendment like that might work, let's look at one we already have. The 22nd Amendment says, hey, two terms in office and that's it, 2 4-year terms, ratified in 1951 after Franklin Roosevelt had served, elected 4 terms, served 3 and some of that. Can you talk about the reasoning behind that amendment? And you write, not just as Republicans angry at Roosevelt, but as a tool to keep one figure from dominating American politics.
Sure. So obviously, Franklin Roosevelt was one of this country's greatest presidents, but there were a lot of problematic things about the way he and his administration operated. One of the best illustrations of this comes from 1938, when Roosevelt was under some political pressure, including from members of his own party, and he decided to go after some of the members of his own party, trying to support their primary opponents and get them out of office. For the president to do that would be one thing, but it actually turned out that people who worked for the Works Progress administration, the WPA, were out there working those campaigns, essentially trying to get information out to voters to support Roosevelt's favored candidate. So there was a danger that was perceived by both Democrats and Republicans that FDR was trying to turn the federal government into a kind of giant political machine that would operate on his behalf. And so that led to some changes. It led to something called the Hatch Act of 1938, which you occasionally still hear about in the news today, that says that federal employees are not allowed to get involved in electioneering. It also led to a sort of more general push to depersonalize government and make sure that we got the rule of law and not the rule of men, even from this growing bureaucracy that we had from the New Deal. And so that led to things like the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946.
Talking to Philip Wallach from the American Enterprise Institute, he wrote a piece in Politico magazine saying, we need a new constitutional amendment that says, if you are a spouse or a kid or a sibling of an American president, you don't get to run for president yourself. Good idea, bad idea, what do you think? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. So I've summed up a couple times, Philip, this idea for a new constitutional amendment. Lay out how you see this working, who in particular would be barred from seeking the White House.
Well, to be honest, I haven't thought through all of the nitty-gritty details, but the general idea is just, yeah, if you're a close family member of somebody who has served as president, we're going to say, sorry, you're not eligible yourself to become president of the United States. And I threw out there spouses, siblings, children, people who have talked to me about this piece and said, what about ex-spouses? I get rid of them too. My feeling is, you know, the contribution that we can get from any of these people is just not necessary for our American republic to function in a healthy manner. And the cost of having the shadow of these families hang over our politics is really quite immense. And so, you know, there's a certain sense of unfairness. This proposal, I'm surprised how much it does, but it seems to offend people's sense of fairness. Well, they should be allowed to run just like anybody else. that's not what it's about. It's about making sure that our republic functions well, and we would do better without having this family overhang.
I want to give a listen to a woman whose family would have been affected by this amendment, the wife of one president, mom of another, and mom of yet another presidential hopeful, Barbara Bush, former first lady, talking in 2014, asked about the possibility of Jeb Bush running for president. Here's a listen to some of what she had to say.
I think this is a great American country, great country. And if we can't find more than two or three families to run for high office, that's silly, because there are great governors and great eligible people to run. And I think that the Kennedys, Clintons, Bushes, they're just more families than that.
Could you talk about that statement? If we have these dynasties, her concern there in a family that was at the center of this, are we reducing our talent pool for higher office?
Absolutely. That's exactly my argument, is that we are sort of drinking stagnant water when there's no reason for us to do that. It's a huge country with so many talented people, including talented government administrators and managers who would make great presidents. And we need to expand our idea of who ought to be in the presidency rather than just going back to these same families. And I thought Barbara Bush, that interview that you just played a clip from, was right on the money. Unfortunately, she changed her tune, got behind Jeb finally in that campaign in the following election cycle. But I think she nailed it there. We don't need to depend on the same families, and it's an unhealthy tendency that we have to do so.
Why is that? Why do we do that as Americans? In theory, the country was started with the idea that we shouldn't be ruled by literal dynasties. Why have we sometimes, do you think, gone back to Adamses and Kennedys and whatnot again and again?
Well, I think there's an undeniable value to the celebrity that being a child of a president can bring someone. And so it just gives someone a real leg up. It gives them something to strive for. And it makes a certain amount of sense just in terms of our human attention spans. But especially in this age of social media, where there's a chance for individuals and families to sort of grab hold of the emotions of their followers and manipulate them on a regular basis, I'm worried that connection is overpowering our more rational impulses to look for the most able men and women to lead our government.
We're talking to Philip Wallach right now, senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, looking at a piece he wrote for Politico magazine, calling for a constitutional amendment that would bar close relatives of former presidents from being president themselves. The goal, to keep us from having and relying on political dynasties. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of family members of ex-presidents being ineligible to serve in the White House? And whether or not you like the idea of a constitutional amendment on the topic, do you worry that we go back to certain political families, in effect, dynasties of people to go into higher office in the United States? If another Trump or Obama or Clinton or Bush or Adams or Roosevelt ran for office, what would you think about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Philip Wallach, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, about his idea for a constitutional amendment to prevent close family members of former presidents from running for the White House. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like that idea, keeping close family members of current and former presidents out of the White House themselves in the future? Do you worry that we go to political dynasties again and again? Clinton's, maybe Trump's in the future, Bush's, and so on. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Lynn is with us in Dubuque. Lynn, hello.
Hi, this is Lynn. I am just overwhelmed at what I'm hearing. How many more changes in the Constitution does the left want? They're just afraid Trump's son or Hunter would get in the next time. And I just can't believe what I'm hearing. Change the Constitution. Change the Constitution. What are you afraid of?
Lynn, thanks for the call. Hunter would be Joe Biden's son, but concern about Donald Trump's children possibly running for office. I don't know. Are you motivated by a perspective coming from the left, Philip?
I'm certainly not. I'm not a man of the left at all myself, and I share the caller's concern for changing the Constitution without thinking about it, but. This is something that I'm trying to ground in a good conservative tradition. That's where the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution came from, and that's where this idea would come from, this idea of what I call anti-Caesarism, this idea that as part of the Republican tradition in America, that's part of our nation's founding, we're against monarchy. We're against the idea of elevating any one family to this place where it can dominate our politics for generations. And I think we should reflect that in the Constitution. So I don't think that that's a radical or certainly not a leftist move. And as I said, this was something I'd been thinking about before Trump ever came onto the political scene.
Thanks for the call, Lynn, at 800-642-1234. And we did have two Bush presidencies, a one-term and a two-term presidency. You know, there were commonalities, of course, in their politics. They also each brought their own perspectives to the table. They were different people. Do you really see that as an example of, you know, a potential slippery slope to Caesarism, to some sort of domination of politics by one family?
Well, listen, I would say plenty of things in defense of both Bush presidencies, and I'm plenty of things critical of them, too. I don't think they were extraordinarily bad presidents, really, by historical standards. But when I think about the Bush family's presence, I really do think about that 2016 election most of all. You think about the way that Jeb Bush's presence in that way drew all this money and attention to him that might well have gone to somebody else who would have been better able to contest that nomination with Donald Trump. I think that would have been a healthier dynamic. Likewise, I think about Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary Clinton, there's a lot to be said for her, but I don't think she was ultimately a very good presidential candidate. And nevertheless, she sort of dominated the conversation about who the next Democratic presidential nominee would be from the time that she became a senator, really. And so in 2008, there she was. And in 2016, she had the nomination. And I just don't think that hanging around those two families was a good thing at all.
Let's go back to our callers now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi, guys. So I kind of both agree and disagree on this topic. I agree because I don't think we should have dynasties. It's too reminiscent of a monarchy, and that's not what America is. And I kind of agree, too, I kind of disagree because who knows what the kid will be like or the other family member will be like. I think the real problem, though, is that running for office requires too much money, and there are so many people out there that are running for these offices, but they can't afford to put themselves out there. So like your guest said, who might be better able to run the country or run an office? We don't know because we never see most of the people that are out there that are running.
Michael, thanks for that call. And that's an interesting point. And you've kind of touched on this a little bit, Philip, that the bar to running for president is kind of high. It's expensive. And this name recognition of a Clinton or Bush or whatever gives you a certain leg up. Is it a thing where we need to change the process to bring more people into the mix rather than do it by excluding some people with that last name from the mix?
Well, I think we have to look to our parties, who are really the ones most responsible for choosing who ends up on that final ballot. And I think both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have been struggling in recent years to try to figure out, well, how can the party project its own influence and its own sense of who who would be a good president into figuring out what that pool of candidates should look like. And mostly they haven't really figured it out. They've mostly found themselves sort of playing defense against outsiders who bring name recognition into that contest. Trump wouldn't have been the first one. You think of Herman Cain in the previous election cycle. And so I do think we need to think about how our two political parties could do a better job supplying us with a pool of talented candidates.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Philip Wallach from the American Enterprise Institute about his concerns about political dynasties in the United States. Maybe a constitutional amendment, he says, to keep spouses, siblings, children of presidents from running for president themselves. Let's go back to your calls. Bev is with us in Dodgeville. Bev, hi.
Hello. My question involves not necessarily the president, but what about the members of Congress? What about a term limit for those individuals? We have people in Congress that have been there. It's like their full-time job. It's their whole career has been there. What about those people? Shouldn't we have some type of term limits on their positions?
Bev, thanks for the call. We started talking about that 22nd Amendment and term limits for presidents, Philip. Bev says, why not members of Congress?
Well, I'm very much against term limits for members of Congress. I think it would end up depriving Congress of some of the most talented and experienced people that give Congress some of its clout to stand up to the White House, which we need more of right now. Congress is really finding itself dominated by the executive branch far too much in our current politics. So I did say in my political piece, I say we could think of extending the same spirit of this amendment to members of Congress. It's a little bit strange how many members of Congress came from political families. That's the biggest way to get a leg up on a congressional seat is to have had somebody from your family be a politician before you. And so I think we could consider extending the family ban to people trying to run for Congress, too, although it wouldn't be a necessary application.
And thanks for that call. Philip, just in our last minute, do you see a way to expand our pipeline of talent, whether we're talking about Congress or White House races, so that it isn't just those people who have that family background in politics that are the first to think of running?
I mean, I think the pools we get are so shaped by the party. So we really, as individuals, we need to think about how to engage with those political parties more. And I think, you know, it's a trend in recent years to see more and more people registering as independent and not as members of parties. And they're sort of against one party more than they are members of another. But I think we need, as citizens, to think about how we interact with those parties, whether they're serving our interests, and if they're not, maybe we need to become more active as citizens in encouraging them to provide us with different kinds of candidates for federal office.
We'll leave it there, Philip. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
That's Philip Wallach, senior scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he researches the separation of powers and Congress. We've been talking to him today about his piece for Politico magazine, where he calls for an amendment barring former relatives of former presidents from also running for president. He says maybe spouses, siblings, and children, though he says the details are open to negotiation. You can find a link to that piece, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics, including the Biden administration's reaction to rising numbers of asylum seekers at the U.S. border. A Wisconsin woman got national attention when she returned a library book that was 63 years overdue. She shares her story and her time in the national spotlight. And Wisconsin is home to unique artists who have created whole environments for the public to enjoy. We'll check out a new museum exhibit on outsider artists. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Last year on the show, we heard from Janelle Shane, artificial intelligence researcher and author of the book You Look Like a Thing and I Love You. As part of her work, she trains neural networks in human language and has them come up with things on their own, like paint color names, cookie recipes, and more. The results I often find hilarious. Well, this week she's out with a new one, a compilation of pickup lines created by the finest artificial minds in all the land. Here are some of them. Singles, get a pen and paper out. These are winners. The program Da Vinci came up with some of these winning pickup lines. Here we go. I'm losing my voice from all the screaming your hotness is causing me to do. You have the most beautiful fangs I've ever seen. I love you. I don't care if you're a doggo in a trench coat. I will briefly summarize the plot of Back to the Future 2 for you. I think I may know somebody who's tried that one. I once worked with a guy that looked just like you. He was a normal human with a family. Are you a normal human with a family? These next pickup lines come from a program called Curie. Your eyes are like two rainbows, and a rainbow of eyes, I can't help but stare. Picked up some pretty flowers. Want to smell them? Here, try to take my hand off. And the classic, hello, my name is Natasha Dawson, and I'm sure I'm a lot prettier than a picture of you on tinfoil. Finally, the program Babbage. I love you, I love you, I love you to the confines of death and disease. The legions of earth rejoices. Woe be to the world. And will you marry me? You can follow Janelle Shane's work at AIWeirdness.com. This is Central Time.